Here we go. Okay, hi everyone. I hope everyone's having a great night and welcome to tonight's Torah in Motion, Parshat HaShavua Shi'ur. I'm going to be sharing my screen throughout. As you can see, the source sheet is there and I believe it was emailed out in advance, but I'm going to post right now in the chat the link also to the source sheet. So if anyone wants to open it on their own, they'll have access to that as well. And with that, kind of the technical requirements out of the way, we will begin. So I'll introduce myself. My name is Sarah Gordon. I currently serve as the Senior Director for Israel Education for Unpacked for Educators, a division of Open Door Media, where I work with schools all over North America on Israel education and implementing our content and resources into their curriculums. If you want to check us out online, you can search Unpacked on YouTube and you'll get a sense of our curriculum and our Israel videos. I'm speaking tonight from Teaneck, New Jersey, where I live with my family. And previously, I taught Talmud for many years at Mayanot Yeshiva High School, where I served as a director of experiential education and Israel guidance. And I want to thank Torah in Motion and Rabbi Kelman for asking me to speak. And I'm really excited about learning together tonight. So with that, as we wind down Sefer Devarim, we have a few mitzvot left to be given. And one of them is mentioned in this week's set of parshiot of Nitzavim Vayelech, and that is the mitzvah of Hakel. And the mitzvah of Hakel is outlined for us in Perek Lamed Aleph, Perek 31 of Sefer Devarim. And it's supposed to be an extremely powerful ceremony, one that happens every 7 years at the close of Shemitah. All the people come together. The Torah is read. I actually went to a Zecher LaHakel, a remembrance to Hakel events in my second year learning in Israel after high school. I was at the Kotel. There were thousands of people there. The chief rabbi read the Torah and the president was there of Israel. It wasn't the biblical Hallel, but, a remembrance of it, but it's still something, the state of Israel enacted. It was still something that was a huge event and a huge highlight of the year for me. And this mitzvah of Hakel is what I'd like for us to discuss together tonight. I'd like us to really do a deep dive into this mitzvah. We're going to look into the psukim, the verses in Sefer Devarim, and see how the ritual is then expanded and defined by the rabbis in the Mishnah and Sota. And we're going to talk about the who, what, where, when, and why of Hakel, and how this can hopefully give us more insight about its goals and purposes. What is Hakel supposed to accomplish? What impact is it supposed to have on the people who attend? And we'll see the different approaches taken by medieval and modern commentators to answer this question. And throughout this, hopefully, we'll also keep in mind what are the takeaways we can have from Hakel as modern day readers, and what can we take away from this ceremony to our lives practically today, and specifically perhaps the Yamim Noraim, the high holiday period that we're about to enter. So I hope for this to be as interactive as possible. I'll pause every so often for reflection. People can post comments in the chat. Hopefully I'll have a chance to see them because I'm sharing my screen. And we'll hopefully have a chance to hear from different people as we go through the Shi'ur. Okay, so with that, let's begin. So we'll go to the source sheet. And before we actually look at the psukim, at the verses of Sefer Devarim that talk about Hakel, I actually wanted to share an excerpt from a book called The Power of Moments by Chip and Dan Heath, which is a book which I think can really help frame our discussion today. Some of you might be familiar with this book. I actually read it when I was running student activities at Mayanot, at the day school I was working at. And it talks a lot about how moments, really the most powerful moments in our lives, don't happen randomly, but can be created and orchestrated. And it talks about a few elements all great moments have in common these specific elements that they really need in order to be transformational moments, in order to be moments that can really have a deep impact. If you look at source number one, I just pulled an excerpt from this book, and the Heath brothers over here suggest four elements that great transformational moments need. The first one is elevation. Defining moments rise above the everyday. Moments of elevation transcend the normal course of events. They're literally extraordinary. Number two is insight. Extraordinary moments, huge transformational moments have like an aha aspect to them. Defining moments rewire our understanding of ourselves or the world. We realize something that might influence our lives for decades. Number three is pride. Defining moments captures at our best, moments of achievement, moments of courage. And finally, number four is community. Defining moments are social. They are shared with others. And these four elements are ones that I want us to keep in mind, especially as we think about Hakel, because Hakel, in its essence, is supposed to be one of those transformational moments. And I'm curious, as we learn through the texts, about Hakel, to see which elements from these power of moments are actually found within the ceremony. And I just gave a second quote kind of over here, which is again another quote from Power of Moments, where the Heath brothers here focus again on the fact that moments don't happen randomly. Great moments are intentional. There's thought put in. They're really kind of thought out on how to create really powerful moments. And I think we're going to see that intentionality present very much in Hakel as well. And with that, let's jump into the text of Hakel over here, which is source number 3. I'm going to read it in the Hebrew and I'll translate as I go along, and you can follow along in either the Hebrew or the English as we go through it. Okay, so here we go. So Dvarim Perek Kabbalah, this is Dvarim Perek 31. And it starts off by telling us the following, Pasuk Tet, Pasuk 9. Vayeftov Moshe et haTorah hazot, vayitnala kohanim b'nei Levi, nosim et Aaron v'rit Hashem, ve'el kol zikne Yisrael. So Moshe writes down the Torah, this teaching, and he gives it to the kohanim and to all of the zekidim and to all of the elders, kind of like a moment, almost a visual moment of transmission of Moshe giving the Torah, you know, to the kohanim, to the zekidim. Pasuk Yod, Pasuk 10. Vayitzav Moshe otam lemor. Miket sheva shanim b'moed shnat ha-shmita b'chag ha-sukot b'vog kol Yisrael lirot p'nei Hashem lokecha b'makom asher yivchar tikrat ha-torah hazot neged kol Yisrael be'oznehem. So Moshe commands him, saying at the end of every 7 years, when at the closing of the Shemitah, of the 7 year Shemitah cycle on the holiday of Sukkot, when all the Jewish people come to see God, right, on the one of the three pilgrimage festivals, here being specifically Sukkot, you should read this Torah in front of or to the ears of the entire Jewish people. Pasuk Yudbet, Pasuk 12, Hakel, here's the name of it, right? Hakel, gather at Ha'am, gather the people, Ha'anashim, Ve'hanashim, Ve'hataf, men, women, children, Ve'ger, Fasher, Bishuracha, the stranger converts in your midst, Leman Yishma'u, Leman Yilmadu, Ve'yiru, Tashem, Lokecha. So they should, here we kind of have the reason, right, the rationale for Hakel, so they should hear, and they should learn, and they should revere God. And they should keep the entire Torah. And Pasuk Yud Gimel, the final kind of Pasuk over here. Here we focus on the children. So the children who don't know, right? Because here, right, we're in the desert, right? We're about to go into Israel. These are children who have not perhaps had these experiences. A lot of kind of Pesach Haggadah vibes kind of going on over here, right? Your children who the children who have not had this experience shall hear and shall learn and shall, you know, fear or revere God all of the days that you're living on the land here, specifically the land of Israel, that you are about to enter and cross over the Jordan, to inherit. So here we have kind of the original text, right, describing Hakel. And I'd love to pause for a second and really just feel free to post in the chat or to unmute if you want to raise your hand. I think that maybe that might work as well. What aspects of the ritual of Hakel that we just read seem particularly notable? What questions kind of arise about Hakel? And what really seems to be the purpose of the ceremony? So I'm just going to pull open the chat so I can see responses. Feel free to kind of post any questions you have, anything that seems particularly notable about this, what seems to be the purpose. And if anyone has any comments that they want to share, feel free to unmute yourself as well. And we'll take a couple of comments maybe before we move on. And I see a comment. All right. No name. The name says iPad, but an interesting kind of thought, right? Someone wrote for transformational moments, right? But if it worked, what about the prophets and their rebukes? So hang on. We're going to get to that at the end. The question of kind of like these big moments, do they actually work? Do they have an impact? Or does it just kind of wear off? Right. And so what we're going to talk about that. So it's a great comment. And if anyone has questions, like what questions kind of arise about Hakel? What seems to be particularly standing out to you about this ritual? We'll give everyone a moment. I spent many years as a teacher, and they always teach you about wait time. You're supposed to wait to give people a chance to answer the question. So I'm happy to wait a minute if anyone has comments or thoughts. You can feel free to post in the chat if anyone has live action comments.
Well, it's one of, I'll be your huckleberry, as they say.
Thank you.
It's one of the more inclusive ceremonies because they do spell out all Israel, and they define Israel as men, women, and children. So it's a very inclusive thing, which most of the other stuff isn't.
For sure. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And we're going to dig into why. Why is it so important that every single person, the Jewish people, no matter what their conflict or how difficult it may be for them to come has to be there. So great, great points. Anyone else? Anyone want to jump in or share anything? Anything that jumps out to you after a first read of the Psukim on Hakel? People can keep thinking. If you want to jump in, you can. Otherwise, definitely feel free to keep posting in the chat. I'll share a few kind of framing reflections as we move forward. And I think that again, kind of as we saw from the Psukim, first of all, why does Hakel happen specifically after the Shemitah year, right? Why not just after the Shemitah year, but why specifically right after the Shemitah year on Sukkot? If it's such a big deal and it's such an important ceremony, why are we having it once every 7 years? Let's have it every year. Why kind of the wait? Why the cycle? Another interesting point that different commentators bring up, the Torah, quote unquote, that we're reading at Hakel, what is that? Is that the whole Torah? Is that all of Sefer Dvarim? Is that specific passages? So we'll see how that gets defined by Chazal in a minute. As someone right just commented, why is everyone coming? Why is it so important that everyone has to be there? Finally, what's the goal? We saw in the text, and I underlined it, right, that it says, so people should come, so they should hear, they should learn, they should fear God. Laman, right, Yilmadu, Yeru, Yishmaru. But can we dig a little deeper into that, right? How does this ceremony lead to more observance, to more fear, to more reverence? And finally, why are we talking about this mitzvah of Hakel now at the end of Dvarim? Maybe it's connected, right? We're about to go into the land. People are about to kind of spread out a lot, kind of all over Eretz Yisrael and kind of retreat to their farms, and they're not always going to be centrally in Yerushalayim. So maybe it's important now to kind of have this to kind of teach about this big ceremony that's going to keep them connected. But again, we saw before even kind of the connection to Pesach, right? This idea of this is a ceremony perhaps even focused on children. Like we want children to be there, to have that connection, to learn. So a lot to kind of think about on that. So with that, I actually want to jump to source number 4, which is the Mishnah in Sota. You can find in the Gemara, Daf Mem Aleph, Amud Aleph, 41a, where the rabbis really kind of expand on the description of the Hakel ceremony, and they add a few interesting things. And we'll read through it. So we're not going to read the whole thing. We'll kind of do a summary, but we'll read through aspects of it. So it starts off at the beginning. I'm going to read the Hebrew, and then I'll translate to the English. Parshat HaMelech Kitzad, how is the portion of this, of the Torah that's read at the Hakel ceremony, read by the king? So first of all, big switch, right? Kind of like now we have the king reading the Torah, right? Reading, being kind of the MC almost of the ceremonies, right? At Hakel, which is interesting, right? The king maybe as like the new leader of the people, the kind of Moshe Rabbeinu stand in, right? Of what's going on with Hakel kind of in Sefer Dvarim. And again, Motzei Yom Tov Arishon Shel Chag B'Shmini V'Motzei Shvi'i, and it happens, right? On Sukkot at the end of the Shemitah year, Osin lo bima shel eitz ba'azara v'hu yoshev aleha. So an interesting kind of other switch. We make the king like this wooden platform, right, in the temple courtyard, and that's where he's standing, kind of this big platform. We'll skip a little bit just to the second paragraph. Chazan haKnesset notel sefer Torah, but notel rosh haKnesset, rosh haKnesset notel askan, v'askan notel kohen gadol, v'kohen gadol notel melech. Etc. I'll translate over here. What we basically have is kind of this big visual transmission ceremony, right? The synagogue attendant takes the Torah and he gives it to the head, and the head gives it to the deputy Kohen Gadol, to the high priest, and who gives it to the Kohen Gadol himself, who gives it to the Melech. It almost sounds like, it feels like you're standing in shul, right? And like there's a lot of Torahs coming out and everyone's passing them, you know, back and forth. It's interesting, right? This almost seems to parallel what we saw in the text of Moshe giving the Torah, right, to the Kohanim, to the Zekanim. So there's almost this visual transmission of the Torah through the leadership. And we'll skip down to the third paragraph. So what are we reading exactly at Hakel? We said the Torah. So how is this getting defined by the rabbis? V'korem mitchilat ele hadvarim ad shma u'shma v'hayam shamoa asar ta'aser v'kitzich leila aser parshat hamelech u'brachot u'klalot ad shegomer kol haparsha. So the king reads the third paragraph in English, selections from Sefer Dvarim, and those selections include excerpts from Shema, from the Shema that we say daily, that talks about, right, reward and punishment, what happens if you listen to God and get rain, what happens if you don't. A lot about the tithes, about the masers, basically. Again, here, this is kind of like the tithes and the portions you have to take as a farmer to give to the Kohen, to the Levi, to the poor, the amount that you have to spend in Jerusalem when you come for Aliyah the Regal. So again, a lot of this is kind of time appropriate because now at Hakel, you're there on Sukkot, on the pilgrimage festival, right? And it's after a Shemitah year, right? So you're kind of like all of those responsibility of who you have to tithe and who you have to give portions to make sure that everyone is kind of taken care of. the brachot and klalot, the blessings and curses, again, kind of a big reminder here of what happens when you listen to God and what happens when you don't. And Parshat HaMelech, the selection about the laws, you know, concerning the king, as the king is kind of the big MC over here for the ceremony. And what I wanted to point out over here, which I think is very interesting, is I think if we go back to those elements from the power of moments, right, the idea of elevation, insight, pride, and community, we see a little bit of that reflected in Hakel. And I'll invite people to share a little bit in the chat if you see where you see those different moments. I'll share a few of my own, right? The idea, and I'm actually just going to jump back up so we can see, you know, the four moments over here. But again, you know, having the king of the Jewish people up there, perhaps a big moment of pride, community, as people pointed out, everyone is joining at Hakel, men, women, and children. Insight, this aha moment, you know, of connection. We're going to see that in the commentators about perhaps in the goals of Hakel, that's kind of present there also. And elevation, this is, you know, it's happening once every 7 years. It's like a big deal. You know, everyone is coming. You're seeing the king read the Torah to everyone. So again, a lot of these elements, which I think as are present in many transformational moments, seem to be present in Hakel as well. So with that, I want to talk a little bit about the why of Hakel. And to do that, we're going to jump now, continue on to section two over here, source number five. And what I want to share are five different commentators. Two of them actually we'll see is the same commentator. He just says different things in different areas. But five approaches to the why of Hakel. And I think what we're going to see when we read through these sources together is that in these five approaches as to what's the goal of the ceremony, what's the bottom line, they're going to fall into two separate categories, though some will kind of draw from both, which I think are two approaches to Hakel, but also could be seen as two approaches to Jewish education as well. And we'll have a chance to kind of unpack that together in the end. So let's jump in. So as we said before, the text itself says the goal is that the people should hear, they should revere God, and they should, you know, listen, right? Yira'u, yilamdu, yishma'u. But we're going to see that the different commentators try to dig a little bit deeper. So let's jump in. So the first one is the Rambam, or Moshe ben Maimon. And he says the following in Hilchot, in the Mishnah Torah, Hilchot Chagiga, in his halachic opus over here. And he says the following when he talks about Hakel. And I'll read kind of the underlined parts over here. He talks about how it's a positive mitzvah for everyone to come. And what are they doing? Velikrot ba'oznehem min ha-Torah parshio shehem mizarzot otam be-mitzvot u'mechazkot yedehem bedat ha-emet. So Rambam says, what are we doing at Hakel? We're reading intentionally chosen passages from the Torah that are going to urge people to perform the mitzvot and encourage them, the Sepharia's translation over here, to cling to the true religion, right? B'dat ha'emet. So it's interesting over here, really seems from the Rambam that the goal of this ceremony, it could be again through inspiration, the goal of the ceremony is practical mitzvah observance. You come to Hakel and this nudges you, mizarez, it pushes you to take on more mitzvot, right? To perform the mitzvot and to really cling to the Torah. And that's what we see here kind of from the Rambam. This is built on a little bit by the Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, a French rabbi who lives a little bit later than the Rambam. And he says the following, and he adds a little bit of a twist over here. Kedei sheyitchanchu kulam la'avodat Hashem yitbarach, velo tishkach haTorah meYisrael. So what's the goal according to the Ralbag? In order to educate everyone to serve God, and so the Torah is not forgotten by the Jewish people. Interesting. And it's almost, I would say, like the Rambam over here seems to be perhaps a little more intellectual, right? It's more about we want people to be doing, or practical, right? We want people to be doing more mitzvot. This is going to inspire you to do more mitzvot. And the Rambag is also interested in this, the educational approach, right? Hakel is an educational activity. But the goal is so we don't forget the Torah. And I think this is an important point I mentioned a little bit before. The Jewish people are about to enter the land of Israel. Everyone's going to go to their own farms, their own kibbutzim, right, all over the land. And if you think about it, if you're a family of six living in the northern Golan, right, in the, I guess, biblical, Talmudic, you know, late biblical, Talmudic kind of era, how often are you schlepping, you know, your family of six all the way to Jerusalem, right? You're probably not going so often. You're probably not even going for every aliyah l'regel, for every pilgrimage. So here, there's a real concern when there isn't this, you know, everyone's kind of spread out and there's no cell phones and you don't have, you know, that kind of instant connection that we have today, you know, with internet and everything like that. that, you know, the Torah could be forgotten. People are going to get disconnected. So what are we going to do? Every 7 years, we're going to have a mandatory reminder ceremony, right? For everyone to come back almost for a refresher course every 7 years. You know, you're going to come back to Jerusalem, a refresher course, so that the Torah is not forgotten from the Jewish people. And I feel like here also, there's a little bit of an educational approach, right? This is coming from, you know, practical mitzvah observance, educational. We want to teach people about the mitzvah. We don't want them to forget, right? It's a little more intellectual. This shifts a little bit when we get to source 7, which is the Sefer Achinuch. Sefer Achinuch, anonymous kind of author of the book of mitzvot, who tries to give a lot of reasons for different mitzvot. And he says the following. I'm going to read the underlined part in Hebrew, then I'll translate in English. And so he starts off actually the first line, which is very important. He says the Torah is the essence of the Jewish people. Lefisha kol ikran shel am Yisrael hi Torah. It's the entire essence of the Jewish people. Now I'll jump to the underlined part. Ra'oi she kalua kol yachad bezman echad min hazmanim. And because Torah is the essence of the Jewish people, it's appropriate that everyone should gather together, you know, once every so often in order to hear its words. And because everyone's coming together, there's almost going to be this big question that everyone, men, women, and children are going to ask, which is, why are we here? Why did everyone come to this great gathering? And what's the answer going to be? Fatihia tshuva. To hear the words of Torah, which is our entire essence and glory and splendor. And what's going to practically result from this? That because of this great inspirational, amazing event, you know, reminding us that Torah is our essence, everyone's going to be so inspired and they're going to tell everyone of the great praise, you know, and splendor of the Torah, and they'll have this great yearning for it. So here, I think we have a little bit of a different approach than we've seen so far in the Rambam and the Ralbag. For Sefer Achinuch, to use kind of a, you know, I worked in a high school for many years. This isn't a refresher course, you know, or a crash course in mitzvot every 7 years. This is a pep rally. This is everyone's coming together to get inspired, right? Of our entire essence, the Jewish people is the Torah. It's a pep rally for Torah. And you're going to be so inspired that when you're done, you can't stop talking about it. It's going to be this great transformational experience, reminding you of your essence. I want to share two more, and then I'm going to pause because I'm curious which ones resonate for people, which ones seem more likely or not. And I want to share two more. The second last one is we're actually going to go back to the Rambam. I know the Rambam said before it's to encourage us to keep mitzvot, but in a different area, and I think these are complementary, these approaches. In the Mishnah Torah, he gives another idea. And here he's talking specifically about converts who are coming to Hakel, who might have difficulty understanding what's going on, perhaps because of, you know, a limited background in Jewish education they're still trying to catch up on. So what should they be doing? And here he says, in the underlined part, Lishmoa be'ema v'yira v'gila v'radza k'yom sh'nitnavo v'sinai. They should listen with reverence and awe and rejoice while trembling, just like when the Torah was given at Har Sinai. And here we see kind of the Rambam pulling on this idea, which we're going to see reflected in the Psukim in a second, that Hakel also seems to be a mini recreation of Matan Torah, the giving of Torah at Har Sinai. And the second part that's underlined, he says also, this person should feel as if he was just now kind of being commanded and receiving the Torah at Har Sinai. And even though this is talking about converts, I think we can extrapolate this almost to the entire ceremony. And if you look at source 9, I gave some, by the way, just some links at the end of the shir of other shirim, other articles you can read if you're interested about this. There's a great article by Rabbi Natty Helfgott about this, where he kind of brings these parallels. So I took that from here. And he points out, right, these and a few different places point this out as well. There are many parallels between how Hakel is described in our parak, that's the source on the left, Dvarim Lamed Aleph, Dvarim 31, and how Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah, is described in Dvarim Perek Dalet, in Dvarim Perek 4, that's the source kind of on the right. And you can see, I tried to color code them. You can see how there's a lot of parallel language. In both of them, the word, literally the word Hakel, gather, is used to gather the people. And then in blue, we see a similar goal, right? What we spoke about before, Yishma'u, Yilamdu, Yiru, right? Bashma'em, Yilamdum, Yira, the same shorish, the same roots of fearing God, learning the Torah, listening or hearing the Torah as well. And finally, in both, in red, I highlighted you have this idea of children, right? The fact that this is an experience that's there also for the next generation. It's important for everyone to be there. We want to remind this to the next generation. And we see that as well. So this is kind of our second last approach, that it's a mini Har Sinai experience. It's taking us back to Har Sinai, to our roots. And the final approach, and then we'll pause for some reflection, is from Rav Hirsch. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch talks about how maybe this isn't about, you know, a crash course to remind us so we don't forget the Torah, or to inspire us for mitzvah observance. And the other approaches we saw as well, right, this idea of you know, the pep rally, or the Rambam here, the mini Har Sinai. But maybe this is about proper framing for the upcoming year. And here, Rav Hirsch talks about the fact that Hakel is intentionally placed at the end of a Shemitah cycle, at the end of the seven-year cycle, at the end of the year of Shemitah, where everyone has hopefully had a very spiritual year of not working, you know, and hopefully focusing on their spiritual needs. He says the following, and I'm actually going to read, I'll read the whole thing kind of in English. This reading out of the Torah prescribed here is not meant to be a means of the people getting to know the law. That, of course, should be nurtured daily in the ordinary life at home. And I'll comment over here, right? He's saying this isn't an educational learning experience, which sounds perhaps a little bit different from what we saw in the Rambam and the Ravag. And this is about just learning mitzvot, learning what to do. Do that at home the rest of the year. That is not what Hakel is about, according to Rav Hirsch. So what is it? It is something extraordinary, which recurs from the seventh year to the seventh year for quite a special purpose. Sounds like power of moments over here, right? This is something that's elevation, right? We have something that happens not every day. And moreover, b'moed, at a time which invites every Jewish soul to a meeting with God, the year of Shemitah. It's intentionally placed to end with Shemitah, kind of this very special time. It's the end of Shemitah. We've come in Aliyah L'Regel. We're all gathered in Jerusalem on Sukkot. At every restart of a period of agriculture and business that has been interrupted by the year of relief and remission, meaning Shemitah. On Sukkot, when the festival assembles a national circle all together in remembrance of a time when it was not agriculture or business, but where the miraculous grace of God provided for everybody. And here Rav Hirsch is saying, you know, you just spent a year not working and trusting in God to give you everything you needed, right? So what are we going to do? That's a perfect way to kind of like come into Hakel and rededicate ourselves before we re-enter the workforce. We're about to have another six-year cycle of working where there might not be so much time for spirituality. So this is the time, as we go from our spiritual year where we trusted in God to our six-year cycle of work, to take some time and have Hakel, right? And here, with every entry of a period of agriculture and business, the consciousness proclaims itself ever afresh that the way to God only lies in the way of his Torah, and the bond with God is a bond with his Torah. So again, kind of for Rav Hirsch, it's about timing. Why is this done now? It's very intentional. This is a framing to help prepare us for the next year. So we saw those five approaches, right? Is this to urge us to keep the mitzvot? Is this so we don't forget the Torah? Is this a pump up rally, a pep rally for Torah as our essence? Is this recreating Har Sinai? Or is this framing for the new year? And I think underlying all of these approaches is really the question, I didn't give it in detail before, but I'll expand on it now, which is Hakel more of an intellectual experience, or is it more of an emotional experience? Is it about getting inspired to do mitzvot, to do more mitzvot, and we'll have better mitzvah observance by hearing these certain texts and sefer dvarim? Or is it that the emotional experience of Hakel is going to inspire me and get me fired up and want me and help me kind of connect to Torah? So is it more intellectual, right? It's more kind of like I'm learning more, I'm being reminded of mitzvot, I'm being reminded of my responsibilities. Or is this overwhelming, powerful emotional experience that hopefully gets me very spiritually connected and like ready to go, whether it's for the next year, like Rav Hirsch, whether it's the Har Sinai aspect, whether it's Sefer HaChinuch, right? That's saying it's like this pep rally. So which is it, right? And we see both of these kind of reflected. And I think this can be applied to kind of a contemporary debate that goes on today about Jewish education. And again, there's different aspects to Jewish education if we think about what we want from our communities, what we want for our children, what we want for our grandchildren, right? On one end, there's the practical aspects of Jewish education. We want our Jewish schools to teach kids how to live like a Jew, right? You need to know the mitzvot, the what, and the how, and the when, and all the details. At the same time, there's the ruach and the spirit and the inspiration, right, of Judaism, right? Why are people going to commit themselves? Why are they going to find this meaningful? We have to also light that fire. We have to inspire people. And often this debate gets classified into, well, there's formal education, then there's informal, right? There's the classroom, and there's the Shabbatons, there's school, and there's camp, you know? And this often gets into a debate, you know, do we bring more of the informal education into formal education, more of the ruach into the schools, but how do we make sure we don't lose the rigor of formal education? So I think a lot of that contemporary debate that exists today is a little bit what we see here with Hakel, right? And I think we see both aspects. for different commentators, sometimes it's more about the intellectual aspect, while other ones see it more as the emotional experience. Even though for all of them, it ultimately gets you, hopefully, to, you know, be more inspired means more mitzvot. More mitzvot, hopefully, means more inspiration, but they're getting to it in different ways. And I'm curious, and please feel free to either unmute yourself or share in a chat. We'll pause a little bit for reflection. I'm curious if any of these approaches kind of speaks more to you about Hakel, if any of these kind of resonated more than any of the others, if you see it more as intellectual or emotional. And I'm curious if you will take a moment, if anyone wants to share, share their thoughts. And you can feel free to use the chat also if you want to add that there. Okay, well, people do have comments. You can feel free to jump in. I see it's more of a quiet group, totally fine. But if more people have comments, feel free to add to the chat. So we saw the different commentators, Red and Hakel, different reasons for it. That was the why. And what I want to do now with the kind of second half of the shiur is to talk about the when and the who of Hakel. I'm seeing actually a few comments or comments. So great. So Stephen shared, right? Seems harder to see it as intellectual given the sheer scale of event for sure. I think that's a really interesting question, right? Practicality, like how do we know, were people really able to hear, you know, what was going on? And I think that's a good point, right? If it's about the intellectual nature, you need a notebook. Like you got to be taking notes about this, right? How is this going to, what message, what part of the inspirational speeches and shirim, right, is going to spark my observance? I want to take notes. But if it's about the experience, and we're going to get to this kind of in the next section, what does it matter if I heard anything, right? And that's going to connect to when we talk about why are you schlepping your kids there? Like, what are they going to get out of it? Like, they're not going to understand the speeches, right? And here it's true. Like, what if the adults can't even hear? I hear also, right, people saying also, right, a big public gathering would probably be inspirational for sure. Perhaps the public nature of it, right, seems more about the spirit. So again, right, interesting to see that perhaps it's leaning more emotional over perhaps intellectual, even if it's still getting us that same place, definitely. And please feel free to keep commenting. So let's continue on. Let's talk about the when very quickly, and then we're going to jump into the who, which will take us a little bit more of a discussion. So for the when of Hakel, we saw this reflected already in Rav Hirsch, but I did want to point out Rav Avraham Ibn Ezra mentions this as well, that it is also very intentional, not just that it's the end of Shemitah, but that this takes place on Sukkot. And he says, why? Because everyone's available because they don't need to bring anything into the house here, like the storehouses. All the chores in this case is done. And here I think it's important to note that for Aliyah LeRegel, for the pilgrimage festivals, right, where you had to come to Jerusalem for Pesach, for Shavuot and Sukkot, a lot of scholars note that most people only came on Sukkot. Like Sukkot was the one that got the most amount of people. Because if you think about it in the different times of the harvest, right, like Sukkot is really when the entire harvest is done, right? Pesach and Shavuot, some things are done, but you're planting or it's the barley, but it's this, but it's the wheat. You know, it's not everything is done yet. There was still pressure, like, can I really leave my farm, even my family for sure, but my farm and everything when the harvest isn't done. But at Sukkot, everything is like packaged up. It's in the barnyard. It's ready to go. Like you are done. And there's a reason, right? Also, we see that in Sukkot while we talk about the extra aspect in the Pesukim about simcha, about happiness, and maybe why at Sukkot we have to leave our homes and go to a transient dwelling, right? It's because we're done with the harvest. Our store yards are full. Everything's good. But Ibn Ezra was kind of pointing out, right, this idea that I don't have anything to do, like everything's done on Sukkot, gives me more peace of mind. More people are coming on Aliyah LeRegel on pilgrimage, so more people are available for Hakel. And this is even more so at the end of a Shemitah year where no one was doing any field work for the past year. There's literally nothing was done. So you really have that time, that space. We'd say like there's no lachatz, right? There's no urgency. Like you can come, take the family, go to Jerusalem, have Hakel. And it's kind of arranging in an intentional way that more people would be able to come, which gets us to our next section, right, which is the who of Hakel. And this is source 12. And here I wanted to address that question, and we'll see of why everyone needs to come. And Chazal, the rabbis, struggle with this as well. You know, it's one thing for the adults to come, And even for the children who would understand things, you know, who are old enough, you know, maybe a little bit, a few years below bar bat mitzvah, but why bring the tough, the little children, the children who aren't going to understand? I'll speak personally. I have a 2.5-year-old and I have a 10-month-old, and we went on some day trips a few weeks ago, and it wasn't hot girl, but it definitely was challenging to travel with them, you know, and I can only imagine for families that are schlepping from so far to come to Hakel to bring little children, this is not an easy ask. And this is why Chazal are asked the same question. So I'll just bring up an excerpt. It's a much longer story in the Gemara and Masechet Chagiga, Tractate Chagiga on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph 3a, where Rav Yochanan and Rav Elazar come to meet Rav Yeshua in Pekin, in a city in northern Israel, and they ask him. Or he asks them basically, like, what new idea came out of the Beit Midrash? There's a whole back and forth, like, was there anything new? Was there not? Etc. And here's the idea they present to him, which is kind of our question. Hakel ta'am anashim v'anishim v'atzach. This is the underlined part, the second paragraph. You assemble everyone for Hakel. It's the pasuk. Im anashim ba'im l'mod, anashim ba'ot l'shmoa atzach lama ba'in. K'nei l'ten sfar l'mevayahin. So if the men are coming to learn, the women are coming to hear, and I'm not going to get into that now, or we'll assume this is a sociological kind of assumption from back in the day. But if the men and the women are coming for those reasons, why are the children coming? To give a reward to those who bring them. And that kind of concludes the discussion over here in this Gemara. But this is kind of a little bit of a hard answer. It seems like we're asking adults to bring their young children to Hakel because it's difficult, and when it's difficult, you'll get a reward for bringing them. Since it makes Hakel, going to Hakel, more difficult, and you're doing it, you'll get a reward for that. So the Kli Yakar.
I can't resist because it's just so glaring. I don't understand. The kids are coming because the women and the men are there. What's the alternative? That the women and the men come and they leave their kids behind? What, there were nannies back then, Filipino nannies? I mean, there's a practical aspect to it, that if the men and women are coming, the kids have to come. I don't understand it.
For sure. I definitely hear the practical aspect. So maybe change the question a little bit. So why require, if we know to let's say, and I don't want to get to gender roles here, but if we know it's going to mean that everyone has to come, they have to bring along the kids as well, maybe give some parents an out, right? Maybe give certain, if one parent wants to stay back with the kids, they shouldn't have to come. I hear your concern, you know, with the practicality, but I think it's the same question. Like, why are we requiring the kids to come? Let someone stay home with the kids. They're not getting anything out of it. If no one can watch them, let them stay, or perhaps one relative would stay back, perhaps someone who had trouble, with mobility, and it would be hard for them to travel anyways, right? There's lots of ways that perhaps one person or one member of the family, an older child, might be able to watch younger children, that we'd be able to kind of leave the children home. But it seems to really very much require children to come. And I hear the concern, but the rabbis are still really bothered by this. And it's interesting that the Kli Yakar over here, as I shared before in source 13, he kind of asks this in an even better way. And he says, and I'll read the Hebrew, "Bezed dochak gadol." You know, this is really challenging. To say that we're only bringing the kids so they'll get schar is really challenging. "Kized domeh, ki'ilu tziva, shi'is'u aleihem masa me'etzim ba'avanim le'beit Hashem, fe'li ten schar le'viehen." And if the only reason we're telling parents, and I hear the practicality, but if the only reason we're telling people to bring their kids is so they can get a reward for being difficult, then just command them to carry wood and stones to the temple. Give them a heavy backpack to schlep. Don't make it kids. I was thinking a little bit as a parent, like, I don't know, at least the wood and the stones don't ask for snacks every 5 minutes, you know, like, maybe that's an advantage. But why require the children? And again, specifically within this answer of this Gemara, that the parents will get reward for bringing them. Like, what's this reward? It's just making it difficult. Make it difficult in other ways. It doesn't really seem to be conducive to be helpful. So with this, in source 14, I wanted to share a beautiful answer to this question by the Mea Shiloh, Yishpitz Rav, who says this in the following way. And I'll frame this answer with a little bit of an introduction. He talks about the idea here of the impact and experience can have on children who attended. Someone mentioned this a little bit before about maybe even the adults can't hear, you know, and is it about the hearing or is it about just being here? And I'm curious, kind of amongst us, how many of us remember being kept awake as little kids to watch something? Maybe it was something on TV. Maybe we were brought to some kind of event or experience, not because we'd understand it then, But because this was a moment that we shouldn't miss, something that would inspire something in us later on, even if we didn't understand it then. And I remember as a little kid in my day school growing up in Montreal, I remember them wheeling TVs like into like a room, and we watched the Oslo Accords being signed, and they like brought us all together, you know, and like a bunch of elementary school kids, like little kids, we didn't know what was going on, you know, but like this was something that the school felt, you know, you should be able to say one day, like, I watched the Oslo Accords being signed. And this could be many things for different people. It could be staying up to watch Gilad Shalit being released. It could be, you know, going to a Siyum HaShas, the completion of the Talmud ceremony. And there are many different historical events. And I'm sure different people, and feel free to post things, you know, in the chat that, you know, you remember being brought to as a kid, or experiencing. And again, I think, you know, even if the kids don't get it then, the parents are doing it for a reason. And this is kind of the approach that Meir Shiloh takes, which I think is very beautiful. And what he says in like any of these times, you know, or really I would say parenting or Jewish education as an educator, as a teacher, you never know what's going to stick, right? You try your best with kids. You do the best you can. You never really know what the impact's going to be and what's going to stick. And he mentions this explicitly, and I'll just read the quote. He says, I'm going to start actually from the fourth line in the Hebrew, source 14. Here the Meir Shiloh says that, you know, you don't know what's going to happen when you try to educate your kids, when you try to educate your students. You know, you do your best and you hope. There's no way to logically predict what's going to happen in the future. But here with Hakel, something different is going to happen. And that's what that line from the Gemara means. What does it mean that if you bring your kids what's the goal of bringing kids? To bring a reward, give a reward to those who bring them. What's the reward? That if you bring them to Hakel, usually you're like, I don't know if they got anything from that experience. I hope they did. But with Hakel, it's such a spiritual experience, you know, that it kind of trickles down from the parents to the kids, that you can guarantee and you can trust that here it is going to stick. Like, that's the reward. And it is going to stick. It's going to have a positive impact. And your kind of religious or spiritual goals for your kids, for your students, for your grandkids will come true, at least in regard to Hakka. But I thought it was just a very beautiful idea. You know, this is kind of, you know, especially building off this idea of experiential moments and moments that are about the emotional experiences. You know, again, practically, you know, maybe it's utilitarian and that's why we're bringing the kids. Here's a different approach that perhaps it's really to give meaning as well, that there are experiences that you schlep kids to that they might not get anything out of at the time, but you're hoping it's going to stick later on. And Hakel, here it's almost this idea, perhaps the reward will be that it does pay off in the end, right? And I'm seeing like a few things people are posting, right? Mincha at the Siyum HaShas. I actually saw an article when I was doing research for this year. Someone wrote a very beautiful article about bringing his grandson, you know, to the Siyum HaShas, the completion of Talmud. I think he brought like a ton of snacks, you know, but like he wanted him to have that experience, right? Arrival of relatives from overseas, for sure. The Seder, right? Different times that we, for sure the Seder, right? We're like, we keep kids up, we play games, we do anything to kind of have that experience. With the time that we have left, I want to mention two last points about Hakel, and then we'll have some time for questions if anyone does, and we'll connect it hopefully at the end to the Yamim Noraim, to the high holidays coming up as well. So with that, we're going to go to section 5, which is source 15. I wanted to point out also, as much as we saw the where, the when, the what, the why, I wanted to point out, especially when we see Hakel as this big transformational experience, right? And we saw kind of a lot of those elements of the power of moments reflected in it as well, right? The elevation, it happens once in every 7 years, right? The king and the pride and here the community, right? Aspect, you have to bring everyone. That's what really makes it a transformational moment. What's interesting is later on in Tanakh, and later on, there are two instances of different Jewish leaders who use or borrow aspects of Hakel when they are looking to create a ceremony to help reconnect the Jewish people and re-inspire the Jewish people. When they're trying to kind of create the ceremony and they're looking for a model, Hakel is what they go to. And I think it's because of everything we've learned and discussed so far, Hakel being this great transformational experience that can then be applied to other contexts. So I'll share a little bit of the two examples. The first example in source 15, we go to Sefer Melacha Bet, the second book of Kings, and we get to the story really of Yoshiyahu, who's the king of Yehuda. Now Yoshiyahu, we have a little bit of brief summary over here. Yoshiyahu was a very good king. His father was a very bad king. Before he appeared, there was tons of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry in the land. And Yoshiyahu, when he takes reign, really tries to clean it up. And while he's trying to clean up everything and he's trying to fix the Mikdash and the temple and fix everything up and kind of reform everything, there's some excavations going on. And they find a scroll, which scholars really say was Sefer Dvarim. It had been lost for a time, and they find it. And when they read it, Yoshiyahu and his advisors are horrified because they read in Dvarim and find out all these things that they were supposed to be keeping that they weren't keeping, and kind of all the big consequences that happen if you don't follow God. And, you know, there was a lot of idolatry going on at the time. So Yoshiyahu is very shaken by this, and he wants to kind of do a huge religious reform and re-inspire all the people to religious reform. So he has a big ceremony. And what does he do in the ceremony? He basically takes aspects of Hakel, even though this is not after Shemitah and this is not happening on Sukkot, but it's the perfect model, a perfect template for like a huge transformational rededication ceremony. And you can just see some of the and I underlined it, but I'll just pull out a few of the parallels, which is interesting. First of all, who comes? V'chol ha'am l'mikaton ve'ad gadol, the entire nation from great until small. Here I would say big to little, adults to children, right? Everyone is coming. What does he do? Beikrabos Nehemet Kol Divrei Sefer HaBritah Mitzvah Hashem. He reads the entire scroll that was found, Sefer Dvarim. So maybe here reading a little bit more than what we read in Hakel, but the same kind of idea. Vayimon HaMelech Al HaAmod, and he's standing on a balcony, on a platform. Vayichrot Et Brit Lifnei Hashem Alechet Achar Hashem Lishmor Mitzvotav Ve'edotav. And he creates a huge covenant, or a new covenant, between the Jewish people and God, or here, I guess the people in Yehuda, and God, about rededicating themselves to following God's laws, which basically seems to be a big theme in Hakel as well, in the portions that we were reading from Zvarim about rededicating ourselves to God. And after this, the take action is everyone basically then goes and destroys all the Avodah Zarah, and there's a big kind of religious reform. Even though, spoiler alert, right, this doesn't really stick, this gets to, I think, a question someone asked at the beginning, and we'll touch upon this at the end, that a few generations later, right, everyone's back doing idolatry, and the temple is destroyed, and the Jewish people are exiled, and, you know, we all know kind of where the story leads. But there's this big, at least hope at the time period of Yoshiyahu, that he has this hope that maybe he can pull it together for the people, and the template he uses for a big dramatic event is drawn straight from Hakel. And we see this used a second time in source 16 in the book of Nehemiah in the time period of Ezra. And here we're talking about the second temple period. The Jews are coming back from Babel, from Babylonia to Israel. But as we know, or, you know, might be familiar with, only a small amount of Jews return. They're very assimilated. They're intermarried. They're not keeping Shabbat. They're, you know, they don't know all of the different laws. And Ezra has to do a lot of work kind of getting people back on track. And there's a lot of kind of religious reform and religious enactments that, that Ezra kind of puts together to kind of get the people back and inspired. And then we hit Rosh Hashanah. So again, not Sukkot, not Shemitah, but there's a whole Rosh Hashanah that takes place. And right after or during a Rosh Hashanah ceremony, if you look at Pasuk Aleph over here in Nehemiah Perek 8, source 16, the entire people get together, and they turn to Ezra and they say, the people turn to Ezra and say, Ezra, can you read the Torah to us? And Ezra kind of, you know, it's started by the people, but he puts together this whole ceremony that again seems very much drawn from Hakka. A lot of the parallels you see in Pasuk Bet, Pasuk 2, Me'ish Ve'adisha, Ve'chol Me'vin Lishmoa, men to women and everyone who could hear. Later on, in, you know, Psukim 8 and 9, it talks about how he actually had translators there to translate it, which is interesting. You know, here it seems to be very important to Ezra that everyone really get it, really understand. He has translators because maybe not everyone was fluent, kind of in the Hebrew. And not only that, he stands in Pasuk Dalet, Vayamod Ezra HaSofer El Migdal Eitz, Asher Asula Davar. He's also standing on a big platform, you know, him kind of taking on that role as we see with Yeshayahu, perhaps like the king with Hakel. And again, we see this whole kind of parallel or drawn really from Hakel. And there's a result also here. It says, oh, we'll jump down to Pasuk 10, Pasuk 9. Everyone starts, well, first actually in Pasuk, hey, everyone bows down. And there's this whole rededication kind of to God. And then in Pasuk Tad, Pasuk 9, everyone starts crying when they hear the Torah being read. The same idea that they hear everything they're supposed to be doing and they realize they're falling short on Rosh Hashanah. There's just tremendous crying. And then the Kohanim and Ezra kind of turn to the people and they say, no, you know, it's okay. You can do it. Today's a happy day. Go home and eat. And finally, everyone is resolved and everyone, you know, goes home and eats and everyone gets very happy. And then it says later on, a few weeks later on Sukkot, Ezra then read from the Torah every single day of Sukkot. And Chazal actually looked to this as the origins of the public Torah reading that we do today every Monday and Thursday. So here again, I think these two examples are just fascinating as we have, you know, this Hakel is really viewed not just by the commentators we saw before, but by later characters in Tanakh, you know, later figures in Tanakh, as if you are trying to create a transformational moment, this is a good example to borrow from, to draw aspects from Hakel. And there's some other shurim out there you can find also that talk about perhaps even, you know, the Torah readings we do today, Monday and Thursday, perhaps also are drawing aspects from Hakel, which are interesting as well. But there's really this whole kind of idea of being able to pull from it. And I would say also, I think that we see this in modern day examples as well. I said at the beginning of the Shiur, you know, my second year in Israel, I went to a Zecher LaHakel, a remembrance to Hakel ceremony. And this was one, you know, that the State of Israel started. It was something that, you know, originally Rav Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Te'omim, he was known as the Aderet. He was someone who published a whole treatise saying that, you know, we have many other mitzvot that even though the temple is destroyed, we continue to do as a remembrance of the temple. Why not Hakel? We should still do it, even if we don't have a king, even if we don't have a temple. And the kind of, you know, the Rabbanut, the Zionist kind of rabbinate through the State of Israel felt very strongly that this is a good idea. Now we have the State of Israel. We're not going to do biblical Hakel, but why not have a big transformational, you know, get the president up there, get the chief rabbi up there, you know, and like, let's have like a meaningful ceremony where everyone comes together and dedicates themselves to Torah. Another parallel also that's very interesting is an Ethiopian custom, the Ethiopian holiday of Sigd, which again is something that actually is a national holiday in the State of Israel today. And this is one the Knesset finally adopted it after many years as a national holiday. And this is one again that has its roots in kind of recreating Har Sinai. So there's, you know, the giving of the Torah, and it also kind of takes aspects of Hakel. Again, in Ethiopia, the tradition was you would have this would take place on a tall mountain and you would kind of fence off areas of it. And it really was this enactment of, you know, both Har Sinai, but as we saw, Har Sinai is connected to Hakel as well. This kind of public, you know, rededication ceremony that happens even today in different aspects in the State of Israel. So with that, I wanted to just to recap what we saw today and end connecting it to the Chagim, and then I'm happy to take some questions. So first of all, we spent a lot of time today. We spoke about the four aspects that transformational moments need. Elevation, you know, that doesn't happen every so often. We see that definitely with Hakel once in every 7 years. Insight, an aha moment. We definitely see that with Ezra, with Yeshayahu. You know, the people are really turned by, we see with the different commentators, you know, this approach that, you know, Hakel is supposed to inspire you. It either inspires you to rededicate yourself to mitzvah observance or to not forget the Torah, or you're so inspired by this pep rally that you're running back and telling everyone about how amazing it was. It's helping you with the framework of how to think about the new year, right? Going into the work cycle, the idea of recreating Har Sinai, we spoke about, is it more intellectual? Is it more emotional? And we saw again, not just why it happens right after Shemitah when people have time and presence of mind to go and participate in the ceremony, but why it's so important to bring kids, right? Why do we bring the whole family? Perhaps it's pragmatic, but at the same time, why necessitate that? And we spoke about the idea of sometimes those experiences that you bring kids to, even though they're not going to understand it, because you want this to have an impact later on. And Chazal seeing in the through the Mea Shiloah that perhaps here the reward for schlepping your kids out is that Hakel has the impact you wanted it to have on them, that it really is a moment that stays in their minds, seared in their minds, and that stays with them for a very long time. With that, I want to close with a question someone actually asked a little bit at the beginning, that like, if Hakel was supposed to work, right, why were the Nevi'im, why were there so many problems later on? The prophets had to castigate everyone. And so with this, I wanted to end with an idea also from Rabbi Nadi Helfgott in his article. And he says the following, that big transformational moments in Tanakh don't always work. If we think about it, you know, you have Yitziat Mitzrayim, and 5 minutes later, everyone's worshiping the golden calf, right? Not 5 minutes later, but pretty close to it, right? In the book of Melachim, you have Eliyahu on Har Carmel. He has this huge face-off with the priests of Baal, right? Fire comes down from the sky. Everyone's like, oh, God is the true God. 5 minutes later, he's still being run out of town by Queen Isabel, right? And everyone's kind of like, no one's on his side anymore. So these big transformational moments can be very important to us, but they don't always last. And I think we can see this, people go on a trip to Israel or they go on a Shabbaton, they hear a shiur, it's so inspiring. But 3 days later, it's back to life. You know, we're going to make all these changes. And then 3 days later, we're back to life the way it was. And you know, nothing really, really has been changed. Rabbi Helkot points out, I'm just going to read this quote. And he says, however, past experience has proven that awesome experiences, even that of Har Sinai, are not sufficient to guarantee that the covenant will be kept. And therefore, the Torah ensures us in another fashion, through a second receiving of the Torah, in a personal and private way, the writing of the song and study. And what Rabbi Helkot is referring to here is another mitzvah that's given in Perek Lamed Aleph of Sefer Dvarim, Perek 31, which is the idea of Kitvu Lachem et Hashira Hazot, write down this poem, here referring to the Torah. And the rabbis interpret this as we have a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah that perhaps some of us have done. You know, you fill in the letter, you know, or maybe you've put together kind of an entire Sefer Torah to be written. Or this can be fulfilled in owning Jewish books, in owning Sfarim and learning them. Like that's another aspect of kind of writing down this shir. Rabbi Helfgott juxtaposes both elements. You have the transformational, experiential, awe-inspiring, huge moments of Hakel. But then we also have Katzvu Lahem et Hashir Hazot, the quiet, private times where you're learning Torah, where you're reinforcing certain things for yourself. And I think especially as we come into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, those are the literally the Yamim Noraim, the high holidays, the days of awe, these huge what are supposed to be transformational experiences. But with any transformational experience is always that danger that nothing is actually going to transform. We have all these goals and ideas for the beginning of the year. What's going to stick? And I think perhaps we can take this lesson that you need the Hakel, you need the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you need those big inspirational moments, but we also need that quiet reflection routine, the day in, day out, small changes. Like I think it's been shown that, you know, January 2nd or January 1st, there's a huge jump in gym memberships, right? But 6 months later, how many people are still going to the gym? And I think the people who are still going to gym 6 months later are the people who, you know, started small. They do small workouts once a week, twice a week, you know, and are, have those quiet moments where they keep to routines. And it's not just like, oh, I signed up for the huge flashy gym membership, or I bought the fancy bike or the fancy treadmill. And I think here it's the same idea. You know, we really need both those ideas. Both those elements are really important for Jewish spiritual life, for our own growth. We need the big Hakel moments to inspire us. But then we need the day in, day out, Kibulachem, it's a Shir Hazot, the smaller, reflective, quieter moments to really make sure those changes stick. So with that, I'm going to stay on. So if anyone has questions, I'm happy to take questions. But I want to wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom and a meaningful Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And you can see at the end, I added just a few links if you're interested in reading a little bit more about Hakel and a couple of pictures. This is from the Hakel ceremony in 2022, the last one. And this is a picture from the last SIG ceremony as well, also kind of drawing from that. So thank you, everyone. If you have questions, feel free to unmute yourself or post yourself, post in the chat. And Shabbat Shalom. And we'll end with this. I'll kind of read out.
Shabbat Shalom.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Okay, so I see Steven.
Shabbat Shalom, Shana Tova.
Shana Tova, Shana Tova. Is there any scholarship connection if Generator Moshe is doing in the present? Yeah, so Stephen, to respond to it, I think it's a great question. I think that almost those psukim in Lamed Aleph is Moshe kind of doing Hakel himself, right? And I think almost there's that fear that Moshe has of what's going to happen when the Jews go into Eretz Yisrael and everyone kind of spreads out. So I think he's setting up that template, you know, in order to have something built in where people can kind of take his role and continue doing that Hakel, even that parallel, right? He transmits the Torah to the Kohanim, the Zekanim, and Chazal see in Sota, right? The king gives, you know, everyone's kind of passing the Torah along. So if you can look, actually, I gave some of the articles on over here, actually, Professor Dembski's on the Torah.org, I believe it is, or Torah.com, might be Torah.com, does have a little bit of scholarship. You can look at one that talks about Hakel throughout the ages, and that might be able to help you find that as well. If anyone else has questions.
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
It came to me when you were talking about Eliyahu Hanavi, that really Hashem has to teach Eliyahu that lesson when he's up on the mountain and he says it's not lo barash, lo baruach, lo ba'esh, but called a mamadaka. And the called a mamadaka is really that soft, still voice, which means your inspiration, it doesn't necessarily come from the big events. It's those small, quiet voices or those small quiet moments that you take to, you know, to relate to Hashem in a personal way. And I always think about that when we say Hineni, because we say, the Chazan says, Ubashofer gadol yitaka b'kaldem amadaka yishama. So you have a big event, like a big noise of a shofar, but you also have that kaldem amadaka. So kind of always, I always go back to that, and think of those, that the distinction or the, it's not a parallel, but the contrast between, the loudness or the bigness of an event and the small still moments that really make you connect in a more profound way or a more personal way or a more long lasting way.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think you see that also almost in the Chazan's tune, right? Hineni, like there's the parts he says out like very, very loud, and then all of a sudden it gets very quiet. So for sure. And actually, in Rabbi Helfgott's article over here, he mentions that idea as well of like the exactly as you said for Eliyahu, there's the big Har Carmel. Har Carmel doesn't work exactly. So it's the Kol Zman Hazaka. And even Eliyahu kind of gets fired, right? Like God's like, all right, we're going to try this now with Elisha, who has a very different take, you know? So 100% definitely. All right. If anyone else has comments or questions.
I have a thought for you. Soloveitchik seems to think or espouses that with Yom Kippur, the Yom Mechapers, that in other words, that you might be a sinner and you might have done bad, but let's start the slate clean at Yom Kippur. You live through Yom Kippur. It seems to me that that Shemitah is one of the hardest things to do. If you're a farmer, right? We're not just rabbinic Jews today. Yeah. We're urban rabbinic Jews. We're not rural rabbinic Jews. But if you're a rural person, to give up farming for the year is incredibly hard. And probably you didn't do it the way we'd like to think that people did it. They probably had fences, kept the gates locked so people would have to hop the fence to get the produce and stuff like that. So this is a way of saying, even though you didn't do Shemitah perfectly or well, you start to cycle over again and start to think of yourself as a good person and move forward. I also like to point out there's a little bit of irony about the sugya you gave where the rabbi asked, what did you learn? Because Hakel, let's understand that Shemitah rather is the farmers, the shoemakers, the rabbis, the teachers, the whatever, were still working that year. It's only the farmers who didn't work, the candle makers, the bakers, the whatever specialization they had. And that's what probably the fishermen, and that's what probably people were doing, were even the farmers were either learning new skills or fixing things around their place.
All right, side hustles to try to make some money.
I understand that farmers sometimes let themselves out to farm in non-Eretz Israel as paid laborers elsewhere because they needed the money.
Yeah.
Now, this was a hard thing to do Shemitah.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure it was done imperfectly. I remember learning that for Maaser, aside from Maaser, is only do when you actually sell stuff, not what you leave in the barn until you sell it. But that stuff you didn't bring in through the door, but through the window, wasn't subject to
right.
it. So the rabbis had, so they were doing all sorts of things. Right. And that's in a normal year, let alone a Shemitah year to evade this kind of stuff.
No, for sure. And we see it reflected in the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im talk about it. People weren't keeping Shemitah correctly, appropriately. You know, even in the Mishnah, Masechet Shviit, you hear about, you know, yeah, there are definitely people like who's suspect about keeping Shemitah, who's not suspect, you know. So I actually love that idea you shared, right? That it's almost like, okay, we tried Shemitah. Some people did it correctly. Maybe people did or they didn't. But then before we go back into the, you know, the yearly cycle, you know, you have this Hakel, or as you said, almost like Yom Kippur, where it's like, all right, you know, we tried, but now, you know, we're starting afresh and we're starting anew and we're going to try better next time. So yeah, I definitely think there's always, you know, with all of mitzvot, the idea of like, there's the ideal and then there's in reality, what were people actually doing, you know, and how much were they able to keep this? So definitely, definitely something interesting to think about. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else? Any final thoughts? Otherwise, we'll wrap up. Okay. So again, thank you, everyone. On the top of the source sheet has my email. So if you do have any other further thoughts, please feel free to reach out. I'd love to continue discussing this. Otherwise, have a Shana Tova. Here, I'll stop sharing my screen so I can stop the recording.
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova, everyone. And thank you so much. And Shabbat Shalom.
Yeah.
Take care, everyone.
Shepping Nachas.